Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. The following presentation takes place at the 2010 Forum for Primary Prevention Advocates called Ending Violence Against Women and Teen Dating Violence. Keynote speaker Dr. Elizabeth Reed, assistant professor in the Department of Prevention and Community Health at George Washington University, talks about losing the gender in gender-based violence.
Here's a little bit about what I'll be talking about. First, I'll start off with a little bit of background, including some recent media attention to the issue of teen dating violence. Also, talking about the discordance in frameworks that we've had sort of more recently in the literature on teen dating violence. And I'll be bringing up some of the data that I have from some of our research projects on girls' experiences of IPV and also data from boys that have perpetrated partner violence. And then, of course, conclusions, and we'll have a discussion at the end. So I want to first talk a little bit about my background on this issue. I grew up in Massachusetts. I saw a lot of this happening as a teenager, and I particularly saw the relevance of gender and related gender inequities and norms that were a huge part of this issue, and how boys and girls are in relationships, also like just general interactions between boys and girls. And it really had a profound effect on me. When I went to college, I ended up volunteering at some rape crisis centers locally and working with some of the teen girls. I worked in the emergency room and also as a counselor for some of the girls. It ended up leading me to going on into public health. And in graduate school, I worked as a public educator in some of the schools in Boston for some of the youth around issues around sexual violence and teen dating violence. And then continued my training as a social epidemiologist and continued my work as a researcher looking at these issues. I go back and forth between intimate partner violence and teen dating violence because I see them as the same thing. I think teen dating violence is a type of intimate partner violence, and so I often use them very interchangeably. So the different types of abuse, physical, sexual, emotional. And historically, if we look at the literature and the research that's available, all of these studies, for the most part, have been done among women and girls. A ton of reproductive health effects, including STIs, HIV. This is in global studies across contexts. Unwanted pregnancy, teen pregnancy, rapid repeat pregnancies, and also poor pregnancy health outcomes like low birth weight, mental health problems, depression, suicide, eating disorders, especially among teenage girls, lower self-esteem, riskier health behaviors. We're seeing girls who are reporting partner violence are less likely to use condoms, early sexual initiation, multiple partners, and then they're more likely to report substance use, tobacco use, and chronic pain, GI symptoms, hypertension, and the list goes on and on and on and on. Some of the findings from previous literature looking at the boys who perpetrate. So this is a little bit new. In the past, a lot of the research has really focused on girls who are victims and the health effects, but some of the researchers have really been looking at some of the factors. In order to address this issue, we have to look at the factors that are involved in the behavior around perpetration. So here are some of the findings in some of the recent studies. So men who are reporting IPV are more likely to report traditional attitudes towards gender roles. They're more likely to report cheating, multiple partners, unprotected sex, substance use, exposure to abuse between parents, family violence, victimization, and other types of violence exposure and involvement. And finally, one of the reasons why I have a focus on adolescence and why I think it's so important to look at this issue is not just because it's such a vulnerable period in people's lives and thinking about the effect that experiencing something like this could have across a life course among women and girls, but also because women between 16 and 24 experience the highest per capita rates of IPV. For example, some of the research in local high schools say like 1 in 5 high school girls has experienced physical intersexual IPV and 1 in 10 in the past year. This is largely the extent of the most well-documented research on this topic. It's mostly been focused on victimization experiences of girls and some more recent research looking at risk factors for perpetration among boys. it's seemingly having more of a focus. This issue is a gender-based topic. Last year, there was a lot of media attention to the relationship between Chris Brown and Rihanna. Chris Brown and Rihanna were driving somewhere, and he beat her up so bad that she had to get emergency attention. And one of my colleagues in Boston at the Public Health Commission, he works on teen dating violence issues, one of the men that work in this field. And he went out on the street and surveyed. He took like a convenience sample of a bunch of teen kids in Boston and gave them a survey. And he found that more than half, or less, nearly half, reported Rihanna as responsible for the incident with Chris Brown. And more than half reported that both were to blame. And this is despite knowledge that Rihanna needed medical attention after the incident. And I think while this recent incident represents a really unambiguous example of male-perpetrated dating violence, the survey data taken in Boston really showcase that we still have a lot of disturbing myths regarding this critical public health issue that's really supported among our youth. Fortunately, some of these misperceptions, I think, are not limited to adolescents, but also held by a number of us working in this field. I think there's been continuing discord as to the basic framework for understanding this issue, and particularly around whether this is a gender-based issue. I think in order for us to really move forward in understanding this issue in research and practice and prevention efforts, like, we really have to adopt a common framework for understanding what this understanding this really critical public health problem. And so just thinking about like frameworks, for example, I was looking at like miasma versus germ theory, like whether we think that, you know, we're catching disease because of like decomposing matter that's like in the air or because of, you know, something called bacteria that's, you know, infecting our systems. And I think frameworks are really based on our observations. They're based on current perspectives, cultural beliefs, social norms, your context, personal exposures and experiences, and as well as a number of other things. And so depending on what you think, what your understanding and what the root problem is of any given issue is going to contribute to how you address that problem, and quite frankly, whether you're going to be very successful in addressing it, right? So I was thinking of like when I was a little girl, I was like in Friendly's. You guys have that, they're everywhere, right? Friendly's restaurants. No, I don't know. It's just like a diner. I'm sorry. So I was with my mom, and I had like the worst stomach ache after lunch, and she told me that it was because I had a milkshake with a hot meal, and like you should never combine like cold and hot together. And so I spent my whole life like not combining like hot and cold things together, and like until a couple of years ago I was like, that's kind of silly, isn't it? Like, so I don't know, it's a silly example, but it really illustrates how your framework affects how you address the problem. And I think that, you know, everything is really based on current perception, whether it's social science research or medicine. It's all related to our current perspectives on the issues. So going back to whether the framework around gender-based violence, thinking about whether this is a gender-based issue, about 10 or 11 years ago when I first came into, I feel like I'm going to knock this over, when I first came into this field, I was interested in teen dating violence because of a lot of the work I had done with girls. And I was reading a lot of the literature of the research, and they were really talking about female perpetration and talking about it more as like kids' play. They weren't talking about it like it was intimate partner violence or as severe. They were talking about it as less severe, kids' play. And then, you know, a lot of the studies were even showing that, hey, you know, like, not only are girls reporting perpetration, but they're reporting more perpetration. Like, girls are reporting higher rates. And everybody was, like, loving this, right? And although some people talked about, like, self-defense and said some other things that sort of put it into context, I think this is kind of what started a little bit of a wave of looking at this female perpetration. And they developed a lot of terms like reciprocal or mutual bidirectional violence to sort of explain this phenomenon. where like both partners are really initiating this aggression. Excuse me. And I'll argue that this framework for looking at teen dating violence has affected a lot of our research around adult intimate partner violence. So in one of the papers that it was distributed in your handouts, but we basically like looked at some of the PubMed, some of the research more in the last decade or so of studies, and in PubMed in 2008, 95% of the studies looking at dating violence, using the term dating violence, used a gender-neutral framework, which is really high. However, in 2008, only 20% of the studies were using a gender-neutral framework when looking at adult IPV, so using partner violence as a framework. So it's less. But then if you look a decade earlier, in 1998, the majority of studies back then were calling it domestic violence. But among the 13 studies that I found that were calling it partner violence, only two of them were using a gender-neutral framework. So here is, in 1998, I'm only finding two that are gender-neutral among the adult IPV literature, and now in 2008, we're seeing 20% of the studies on adult IPV. I mean, this is just a sample of the research, but it gives you an idea of how this might be the framework for looking at teen dating violence and thinking about it as a kid's play kind of thing and not as severe. And then, you know, integrating this mutual violence and reciprocal violence framework has also affected the framework around adult IPV. Oh, and interestingly, about 93% of these studies were conducted here in the U.S., the ones that were gender neutral. So I think this is also something that I've only seen people talk about in this country. So, like, coming here to give this presentation, I was trying to think of, like, four good arguments for a gender-based approach. And I think the first three are important, and I wanted to talk about them, but I think the last one is really what is most important. But the first one is looking at prevalence issues. So like a lot of this female perpetration has been found to be in self-defense, and we've seen that throughout the past decade. And it's also just not generally comparable. It's not occurring in a context within relationships that is really comparable to the majority of male perpetrated violence. The other thing, the second argument, was sort of the health costs and associated consequences are greater for girls, like thinking about pregnancy. I mean, biologically and socially, teen pregnancy is a huge consequence of teen dating violence, and something that we see globally as well, STI and HIV anyway. And the third, the measurements that we use do not really measure the specific dynamics of teen dating violence or intimate partner violence. We're using the conflict tactics scale that was not developed for measuring IPV at all. And a lot of times people are only measuring physical violence. And finally, this type of violence has been shown to be rooted in gender inequities and related to these related norms. It's not likely that the etiology of any female perpetrated abuse in relationships is similar. I think what's interesting too is that like out of a lot of the gender neutral studies, if you look at how they express their results and everything like that, they totally stratify by gender. So they give you like an introduction that's talking about this issue and all these health effects that are associated, but then they give you all the findings stratified by gender, so separately by gender. And in my field, like we're taught as epidemiologists, if you're gonna separate anything like that, then you have to have some kind of either theoretical or statistical reason to separate. So you must think that these findings must vary by gender if you're stratifying by gender. But anyway, I just think that's interesting. And thinking about the programs too, that do we have, are there different programs for girls and boys? Are they tailored to boys and girls based on gender? The first one, thinking about prevalence issues. Again, I think said, it's just a lot of this has been found to be in self-defense. I think I've seen this across the past decade in different research studies. Also, with the exception of self-defense, female perpetration is measured by these recent studies is likely motivated in reasons that are not related to any form of like systematic inequality. It's probably more closely related to other forms of non-gender specific unhealthy relationship behavior. So again, these are not really comparable to male IPV violence in such relationships. I don't think there's any population level norms that promote female maltreatment of male partners. So it's really just not the prevalence when people are comparing boys and girls, it's just not comparable. The health costs and associated consequences are greater for girls and women. So looking at the studies across contexts and in every single study, women and girls are more likely to be killed by a male partner than any other class of individuals. Women and girls are more likely to be injured than men and boys due to violence from a partner against, again, across every and each study on this topic. And then also large percentages of women and girls visiting ERs are consistently found there to be as a result of violence from a male partner. And again, thinking of IPV and sexual risk for HIV and pregnancy, and again, this is a study finding that has been found across all studies in all contexts globally. Women and girls reporting IPV are significantly more likely to report STI, HIV, unwanted pregnancy. Women and girls reporting IPV are significantly more likely to report inconsistent condom use, fear of condom negotiation, sexual infidelity, STA, positive or unknown status of the partner. One of the things, I have a friend who works as a midwife in a health clinic up in Massachusetts, actually, and she was telling me about a lot of the girls who are coming in pregnant, but they're not just coming in pregnant, they're coming in pregnant with like STDs and stuff, things like that, and thinking about what kinds of relationships they're in and the rates of teen dating violence among some of these girls. I mean, a lot of the girls that we recruited were from teen pregnancy and parenting programs, and they were the ones that were reporting high rates of teen dating violence. And I'm going to read some of the quotes in a few minutes, but I don't know, it's just interesting. I was at a meeting a few weeks ago for people who are developing teen pregnancy prevention programs, and like all of them were still just focused on girls. So anyway, this is something a little interesting. And then looking at some of the boys' data, even this is a study. You don't have to worry about the numbers or anything like that here. But this is Dr. Anita Raj, who works at Boston University. She's an investigator of this study, but she found that this is among urban men, actually, from health clinics in Boston. But men who reported IPV were 2 to 3 times more likely to have unprotected sex. They were 5 times more likely to report forcing sex, 2 times more likely to report cheating, and while they weren't more likely to report having children, they were almost, or 2.5 times more likely to report 3 or more children. So you can see it on some of the data on the girl side, but you can also see the data. This sort of showcases some of the data that we have from some of the boys and men who are reporting the IPV as well. And also I think it's important to know that there's a study recently that really showcases that women who are in these relationships with male partners who are abusive, they're more likely to report STDs, not just because their partner is more likely to have an STD. Like you can see here that, you know, the men are reporting riskier behavior, so they're more likely to have an STD. But also in the context of the relationship, the men are forcing a lot of sex, so the women don't have as much control over their the frequency of sex and whether they use a condom as well. And that's some of the quotes I'm going to present next. So this was these are some quotes from girls that we recruited from different programs working with girls who are victims of IPV up in the Boston area again. And some of the findings really showcase male partners' control of many aspects related to sex and refusal and sabotage of like condoms and birth control. And I just wanted to warn you guys, I tried to tone down the content of some of these, but it is a little graphic. So you want it 5 times a day, twice during the night. Plus, I was pregnant. If I didn't give it to him, he'd beat the crap out of me. And then he would force me to have it, and I would say no, and he would keep on just doing it. So I'd just lay there and cry and wouldn't care. I think it shows how the context of an IPV relationship can affect girls' control over the like frequency of sex and when she has sex. I'm not going to say he raped me. He didn't use force, but I would be like, no. And then next thing, he pushes me to the bedroom, and I'm like, I don't want to do anything. And then we ended up doing it, and I was crying like a baby, and he still did it. And then after that, he got up, took a shower, and I just stayed there in shock. So again, this quote really showcases male partners' entitlement and control around sex. I told him to put a condom on. He didn't. I went to a clinic, and they were like, oh, he gave you chlamydia. He said it was me messing around with some other guy, and that's not true, because I was like, you're the only guy I was with, and he was like, oh, that's you, you're messing around. He's like, F you, I thought you loved me. And so it's the example of like the male perpetrator's refusal to wear a condom, giving his partner an STD and then blaming her for the STD. So really not taking responsibility for the STD. I was on the birth control, and I was still taking it. And he ended up getting mad and flushing it down the toilet. So I ended up getting pregnant. I found out that before this, he had talked to my friends and told them that we were starting a family. I didn't know that. I didn't want to start a family. I wanted to finish school. In this example, the perpetrator intended the pregnancy, whereas the girl did not. These examples of differences in intentions regarding pregnancy are clearly putting girls at risk for unwanted pregnancy and STDs as well. And so I think these studies, both the stuff with the quantitative data and these interviews, are really showing how girls' risk for STDs and pregnancy are heightened as a result of being in abusive relationships. I think these quotes, and I hope these quotes, give a little bit more of the context of these relationships, or the types of abuse, and how girls' lives are affected, particularly related to pregnancy, and how things like pregnancy can have such a long-term impact in girls' lives. But that leads me on to the third argument, like thinking about the context of these relationships and really needing different measurements for IPV and for teen dating violence that really reflect the specific dynamics, pattern of control and manipulation, and instilling fear. So, is it a quote? It's a quote from Rihanna, the Russian Roulette song. I don't know. I know this seems a little bizarre, but when I heard this song, so this is after the incident, of course, and I thought it was just such a brilliant comparison. Like, I don't know if she meant it like this. I haven't talked to her or anything, but it's such a brilliant comparison. It's really showcasing the context of being in an abusive relationship where, you know, maybe there's like a pattern of ups and downs, sort of like human behavior of being like caught up in the cycle of abuse and experiencing the ups and downs. And when things escalate, like not knowing is this going to be like my time? Is this when my time is up? I don't know if you guys have heard of that. You guys know what the whole thing of Russian roulette is? I had to look it up. But it's basically like, you know, you have a gun in several chambers, and you put one bullet in various chambers. And so the game is sort of to like pass the gun back and forth. And each time you have a certain risk of that bullet being in the chamber that's selected. So I don't know, I just thought it was a really brilliant comparison. Again, thinking more about measurement of partner violence, I think a lot of times, we've been, as public health researchers, we have like a choice of like one measure that we can put in a national survey. And a lot of times people have chosen things like the conflict tactics because it gets at physical violence, and it's probably a pretty good representation of people reporting victimization, physical violence, and probably, like, there's some kind of partner violence perpetration going on there. And so I think that's really why people have been choosing that measure. But I mean, we all know, like, everybody who works in the field, we all know that there's more to this kind of abuse than partner or than physical violence. I think we need more nuanced measures to really capture some of these other elements of partner violence. Like thinking about, it's just funny, like thinking about some of like the older, like the web, the women's experience of battering, it was informed by like interview, like hundreds of interviews with women who were in abusive relationships, but we don't use that. We use a conflict tactic scale, which is like, it was never developed to measure IPV. and this is like, sort of an example, this is around perpetration, but in a recent study, we had a sample of urban boys from clinics up in Boston, and we asked like a typical like one-item conflict tactics thing and asking them about perpetration. And then we used all these qualitative, you know, interviews, and we developed a whole set of other measures to get at partner violence perpetration. And when I just looked at the data like last week, and out of the, for the conflict tactics, one item is like less than 10% were reporting perpetrating intimate partner violence. But when I put all of these sort of nuanced measures together, it was like 30 to 40% were reporting some kind of perpetration. This is what I was expecting to see. This is an urban sample of boys in clinics. And finally, the last argument that I think is really the most important is that male perpetrated violence against partners has been shown to be rooted in gender inequities and related norms. So first, a lot of studies have documented that intimate partner violence is strongly related to beliefs in the inferiority of women and girls and men's and boys' entitlement to control female partners via violence. And we've also seen this on a country level as well, where a lot of country-level data has shown that factors related to gender equality, like civil liberties, political rights, they're related, like inversely related to deaths from gender-based violence. And again, don't worry about the numbers necessarily here, but this is this is part of that study that was up in Boston among men from urban clinics. And we saw that intimate partner violence is linked to both unprotected vaginal sex, but it's also linked, traditional masculine, like, so supporting traditional gender roles is linked to IPV perpetration. So men who are supporting these traditional gender norms are like 2 times more likely to report IPV perpetration. And I think this is like, you know, follows along the lines of Dr. Katz's presentation this morning. And I think, like, throughout history of you know, the majority of the research that's looked at the framework that we've had that's informed the majority of the research that we've had in this field. But, you know, here's the data to back it up. And this is a study that I'm working on right now. It's among adolescent boys, again, in the Boston area. And, again, they were way more likely. So the boys who were reporting IPV perpetration were significantly more likely to report traditional gender norms. And this is a study, actually, that I'm doing. I'm not just looking at partner violence. I'm looking at sort of the link between partner violence and neighborhood violence and gang involvement, and how both of those are really intersecting with the support of traditional gender norms among boys. And so next, I'm going to read some of the interviews that we had with boys. So we had, you know, like I've read a set of the interviews we did with girls who were victims of partner violence, and now I'm going to read some of the interviews that we did with some of the boys that were perpetrators, and we got them from programs like batterers intervention programs. One of the findings, I mean, these boys had several problematic challenges, like, lots of challenges throughout various contexts of their life. But one of the key findings is the maltreatment of girls is really the norm in their, you know, peer lives, but also in, like, every aspect of their life. It wasn't really, like, antisocial behavior, because it's like everything that they see in their lives, they're just acting parallel to that. So this is a quote related to peer context. So regarding girls, they don't know no better. Their mind's not strong enough to basically get over it. Because like a guy could talk to a girl, you bitch, you effing hoes, and that, but she's going to like it because she's going to go think he loves her. Like you could hit a female and she might cry, but when she go home, she's going to love you even more. She don't have that mind power to figure out that you're playing her. Like she'll go for the bait and after that, do whatever you want. Again, like thinking about girls and sex and negative attitudes, or, you know, condoning norms that are negative towards girls. My boy had a party and there was a couple of girls there. We were trying to do something with them and just like lace the blunt, put coke in it. I don't think she knew about it. Her face was like purple. Then after that, I just seen her on her knees for like the whole day. Like she was doing everybody. She probably felt like she was getting terrorized or something. Like they put her in slavery or something. Again, another a quote that's really pertinent to girls and sexual relationships. And we actually found a lot of boys who were reporting trains too. I don't know if you've seen that in your work, where they would like get one girl to come back and they just get her like wasted or high or whatever, and then just all the guys would take turns with her. And they were saying that this happened quite often. But, I mean, there hasn't been a lot of research or anything on it. More quotes on boys' norms related to maltreatment of girls. It's basically just free pussy, and they could F it however, how much time they want, over and over again, until basically they satisfy them. And we asked, so who are these girls? Like, if they're drunk, for some girls, all you have to do is get them drunk, and that's basically it. Again, like similar to the last quote, you're seeing like substance use is like a big factor in getting girls to have sex with them. Like thinking about what the norms are among these boys. And the last quote, like talking about lace the blunt, and some of the girls that we had interviewed had experienced these kinds of things as well, and were saying like yeah, you know, I was so wasted. I was not even conscious. Like I remember this guy and this guy, and I woke up. Like I don't remember who else was even there. Like more quotes on boys' norms and related maltreatment. This is about turning girls out. They could brag about, oh, I turned on this and that. She might be good or look good. She may have a big old butt, a nice little figure. He could basically brag, saying, oh, I turned her out, that's my hoe, like that, basically. Another quote, yeah, we have competitions. So I should take some of these likes out. Well, what we call is turn her out. Like, say one of my buddies gets a girl, we'd be like, oh, bet you can't turn her out, or they'll say it to me, or it's all like a competition, oh, you bet you can't do this or that with her. And saying, like, when I was out in certain town, I used to do it every day or every night. And finally, he turned her around and, like, he's making money with her. That's even more bragging rights. He could brag even more. I think the easiest girl to turn out is a runaway. That's the easiest whore. So I think, even though these quotes are from, like, very urban sample of boys who are in programs for perpetrating partner violence, so it's not representative of like all adolescent boys who are perpetrating. But I think you can really see how the peer context, where maltreatment of girls is highly supported, can really influence how boys are with their relationships with girls and sexual relationships with girls. And I feel like after reading these quotes and seeing the context of these situations, whether it's for girls or boys, like, how can you be like, oh, I don't think gender is relevant here? I don't know. I think that these quotes, like, really stand alone. I think this last argument is really, like, what's important to really maintaining a gender-based perspective on this issue. And so in my last few slides, like, just, again, thinking about some of the frameworks. And the gender-based, like, I was thinking of the two frameworks, right? The gender-based framework, looking at this as a issue of violence against women. I mean, it's rooted in grassroots efforts. It's a community-initiated strategy. It's, you know, from, like, women's rights groups, and it's just, there's been like global consensus of the framing of this issue as gender-based by WHO and other like international authorities on this issue. Violence against women is seen as a clear and continuing threat to the lives and well-being of millions of women and girls globally. I'm thinking about the sort of like taking a gender-neutral approach. It's not grounded in grassroots efforts to address a public health problem that affects people at the population level. It's sort of like an academic production of a public health problem. I think it became more popular after teen dating violence research was thinking about this as like sort of kids' play and talking about reciprocal violence. I think like men and women, sure, both can be abusive in any kind of context or scenario, but I don't think we can ignore the relevance of gender power imbalances and how these play out in intimate relationships between genders and how this has affected women on a global level. And again, thinking about the population, I mean, this just hasn't happened at the population level against men like it has for women. And I think, like, abuse and like, any kind of abuse is wrong, but I think, you know, if we ignore, like, historic and enduring inequities related to gender, then we're going to fail in public health attempts to address this issue. And I was thinking, I've seen some literature on bullying lately, and I've seen, like, stuff on, like, Oprah and stuff like that, too. But, like, you know, they're talking about this, you know, like, a boy who killed himself and was like related or like was killed. I forget how it was now, but like he was totally harassed because of his sexual orientation, and they were calling it bullying. And I was like, that's not bullying. Like that to me, I mean, any kind of violence that's rooted in some kind of like historic and enduring inequity, like the inequity needs to be addressed. Like it needs to be a special consideration of this form of violence. So in conclusion, you know, abuse and unhealthy behaviors can exist across a number of different types of relationships. Like, I'm not standing up here trying to say, like, I think women are like sugar and spice, you know? Like, I'm not saying that women aren't capable, that there isn't some numbers of women who are abusive in relationships. And I think, you know, abuse in intimate relationships should be of special concern. But I think that when we address this issue, we really have to take special attention to violence that's initiated through inequities, historic and enduring inequities. And I don't think we can ignore the fact that the majority of male perpetrated violence against women is rooted in these gender inequities and related gender norms that we have in our societies. And this is like my attempt at like trying to think about this issue. I mean, I'm not very artistic, so, but I don't know if you can even sort of say, but it's like thinking about gender-based inequities, and then, like, we have all this literature showcasing different environmental factors and, like, trouble in school, family disruptions, economic burdens, like, all of these things are factors and that we have seen linked to intimate partner violence perpetration. But I argue that it's an interaction between like social environment that's supportive of maltreatment of women and girls, beliefs around inferiority of women and girls, embracing traditional gender norms, is the interaction of all of these structural factors really that are the primary contributors to male perpetrated violence against women. And when we think of what causes female perpetration, I mean, it's like, sure, we've had some studies looking at self-defense. We've had some other studies looking at some other things, but it doesn't, you know, sort of like conflict management skills and relationships. But there's nothing that systematic social norms that are like affecting women's behaviors towards their male partners. We're not seeing anything at the population level that's affecting women's behavior in relationships with male partners. And so, again, like, I'm not trying to say, like, boys are the source of all evil. I think if we're going to take a gendered approach, then we need to acknowledge the larger contextual influences in terming teen dating violence, like, really thinking about how gender and gender-related norms are influencing boys and girls. A lot of the studies have really looked at individual characteristics of males, like substance use and things like that. And I think from this time out, we need to really think about what are the contexts that are in these boys' lives. I mean, we know that it doesn't occur evenly among all groups of boys. It does affect certain groups more. And I think that, you know, we really need to address this issue that considers factors much bigger than individual decisions and behaviors. First of all, it's important to recognize that if we accept a framework that is gender-based, we need to think about prevention efforts that are going to include some kind of like components that address gender norms or that tailor their program in a way that is gender-tailored. Also, thinking about structural change, like rather than blaming boys, or I think like girls also blame girls too. I mean, I heard that growing up my whole life. Like, that could never happen to me. I think like, oh, that happened to her, but like trying to think of like why she's different from me, why that couldn't happen to me. And I think we blame a lot of like the boys and the girls, but really we have to look at some of these structural factors that are influencing boys and girls' lives. And looking at some of the social norms, particularly thinking about, you know, where I grew up, it's not like who I grew up with and the people I grew up with. This is not why I saw a lot of this growing up. It's not anything about any of us as individuals, it's really about the context that you're in. Also, many gender norms that promote male dominance and control are bad for boys' health too. I mean, we see gender norms are linked to like greater sexual risk-taking, greater substance use, greater homicide, suicide, unintentional injury, all kinds of other injuries. I mean, we see this as linked to sort of these traditional gender norms, like promoting like recklessness among boys. I grew up with a brother who played football in high school, and now like he's lost 9 of his friends. 9. I mean, that's just so unacceptable. It's because of all of these things. It's the suicide, it's the substance use, it's like it's the recklessness kinds of behaviors. And that's so we're not only doing a disservice to girls by not addressing these gender norms, but we are like hugely failing boys too. I mean, that is just it's so unacceptable. Really need health interventions that address these structural influences related to gender norms to reduce not only the multitude of health threats to boys and men, but also decrease violence against women and girls. And we need interventions that really reach both boys and girls. And if we fail to understand the gendered nature of this problem, we really will, without doubt, fail at any kind of policy prevention or intervention effort. And I think that we need to make sure that we have progress in this area to move forward so that we can really prevent this from becoming a pattern of behavior and, you know, lead to other poor health outcomes and behaviors among boys and young men, but also to reduce the impact of gender-based violence across the life course among women and girls.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission or to show your support, visit calcasa.org. That's CalCASA.org.